Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, August 21st, 2020. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney on my last day on Lake George. We can start with good news today. Baseball Hall of Famer Cal Ripken Jr. says he's cancer-free after having March surgery. Orioles Hall of Famer Cal Ripken Jr. has made a full recovery from prostate cancer, he said on Thursday in his Zoom call with the reporters. Ripken, who turned 60 next week, said he was diagnosed in February during a routine checkup and underwent surgery in March. The Yankees' James Paxton is set for an MRI as the Yankees' injuries continue to mount. He felt discomfort in his left elbow and forearm. And this is after the Yankees get word that Gleyber Torres had to exit Thursday's game with a tight left hamstring. Reliever Zach Britton was placed on the IL with a strained left hamstring. There were two positive coronavirus tests among the Mets, one for a player and one for a staffer, and that led to the postponement of the game on Thursday against the Marlins and this Friday's game against the Yankees. Presumably, there'll be more postponements to come because that's how baseball has learned to handle these things. Shut the teams down, isolate, and then get the teams back on the field. That's what happened with the Marlins. That's what happened with the Cardinals. That's what happened with the Phillies. The Blue Jays and Phillies played on Thursday. Toronto won game one. Then in game two, the Phillies had a 7-0 lead and blew it.
And at bat continues with Tellez. Runners at second and third. Biggio on at third. Grichuk on at second. The pitch to Rowdy. Swinging a line drive, sinking in the air to center field. Down for a base hit. Here comes Biggio. Grichuk's on his way to the plate. He'll beat the throw. Two-run base hit from Rowdy Tellez. 9-7 Toronto.
590 Sportsnet, The Fan. The Twins beat the Brewers 7-1 with help from Nelson Cruz.
Twins by one, seventh inning. And the first pitch is swung on, sky to right center field, deep in the alley. Back it goes, deep it goes, and that ball is going to be gone, a home run. Nelson Cruz indeed does snap out of it. He goes oppo here at Target Field. A two-run homer to right center, and the Twins take a 4-1 lead.
Corey Provis on the Treasure Island Baseball Network. The Indians face the Pirates. Shane Bieber was on the mound. You know how that usually turns out.
Now the 1-2. Swing and a miss. Tried to hold up and chased another wicked slider off the outside part of the plate. Huge strikeout for Bieber, number 11.
Tom Hamilton, WTM 1100. The Indians win 2-0. Bieber reduces his ERA to 1.11. We're going to be talking about him with Matt Viscursion coming up. The Rays beat the Yankees again. Mike Zunino pitching in.
Two balls and one strike. On the third base side of the rubber, here it comes, swinging a fly ball down the left field line. It's got a chance to the wall. Gone! A three-run homer for Mike Zunino. The Rays have an 8-4 lead.
Yeah, from 620 WDAE, the Astros took a seven-game winning streak into the game against the Rockies on Thursday, and they continued that streak.
The 0-1. And Toro drives this one deep to right center field. It sends back Hilliard, still going back, looking up. See you later! Into the Astros' bullpen. That's a three-run home run for Abraham Toro, and the Astros have opened up a 10-3 lead.
Robert Ford, KBME, 790 AM. The San Diego Padres just keep on slamming. This was Eric Hosmer yesterday.
Slam Diego, California. Three consecutive games with a grand slam. No team in Major League history has hit a grand slam in four straight games. They're going to have a shot.
Hodge hits one well into deep right field. I thought he got it all. Car rushed. Grand slam home run, San Diego Padres. Where have you heard that before? Repeatedly. It's unbelievable. It's uncanny. It's record setting.
That from 97.3, The Fan. And Clayton Kershaw reached a milestone in the Dodgers' win over Seattle yesterday.
Got him to chase the slider, strike three. And Clayton Kershaw stands alone in second place in the Dodger all-time list for strikeouts, 2,487, passing Don Drysdale.
He tied Don Drysdale with a curveball. He passes him with a slider.
That was Joe Davis and Oral Hershiser on the Dodgers television network. Today we're going to be talking with Dansby Swanson of the Atlanta Braves about what it's like to play in 2020 with the coronavirus and that unusual home run celebration the Braves had the other day. We're also going to be talking to Matt Bisgersian, and we'll have Todd Radom for his weekly quiz. Before we get to all that, don't forget to check out the new anchor to the ESPN radio lineup, Keyshawn, J. Will, and Zubin. I was on with them this morning. A lot of fun, featuring Keyshawn Johnson, Jay Williams, and Zubin Mehente. On from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Time, Monday through Friday. Simulcasting on ESPN2 and ESPN News. And you can also listen to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Dogs are an important part of our lives, and keeping them protected is a top priority, especially against nasty parasites. That's why you got to check out NexGard Plus, a Foxaloner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection that kills fleas and ticks, prevents heartworm disease. Plus, it treats and controls roundworms and hookworms. That's a whole lot of protection packed into a delicious, beef-flavored, soft chew designed to make monthly dosing easy and enjoyable. So the next time you're at the vet, ask about NexGard Plus chews. They're the one-and-done monthly parasite protection you want for your dog. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurological disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting preventive. We're driven by the search for better. When it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Matt Bisgersian is the play-by-play man on Sunday Night Baseball. And Matt, I'm always curious about the answer to this question. I've asked Carl Ravitch, I've asked Boog Sciambi. What have you missed the most as we're going through this odd year where you're doing broadcasts from the studio in Bristol?
You know, you miss the roar of the home crowd when something happens late in a close game. Like, you know, we've seen walk-off grand slams this year. The Padres have, what, grand slams in consecutive games now. The A's have won games, two games with grand slams late. You miss that. And not just grand slams, like a big strikeout with runners in scoring position to end an inning late in a close game. Look, I think the players probably understand and value the role of fans in our game more so than ever before now. And of all the things that have changed, that's the one thing that I hope changes back to normal as soon as possible, because we need butts in seats and people screaming and noise and the ambient noise that the telecasts have benefited from that's being provided by stadium PAs. It's been good. It's been nice. It sounds somewhat palatable, especially when you listen to games on the radio, which I do quite a bit of because I'm in the car a lot. But man, we really miss fans in the ballpark, and that's what I hope comes back soon.
Boy, and an example of that in our Sunday night game last week, I mentioned you guys on the production call yesterday, just watching the Red Sox players. You know, it's one of the worst years in franchise history. The pitching is terrible. The position players every day are staring at a 9-0 deficit. But watching those guys slog through, like they were like the marathoner who needed the crowd to like pull them through a moment. you know, to get them going. Oh, and it does feel like that we see that all the time. National League East matchup this week. We got the Phillies. We got the Braves. I've seen so many beat writers who, you know, covering the Mets or covering the Phillies, covering the Braves, covering the Nationals, basically cast their team situation as a disaster. Well, here's the thing. Like, two of these teams are going to make the playoffs, Matt. Somebody's going to make it through. Who do you see?
Well, I mean, look, you could still throw darts at this and not come up with a terrible answer, because it's just a handful of games separating the top and the bottom of the division. It is the closest of the six divisions in terms of first place to last place. For all the injuries and underperformance that Atlanta has suffered from this year, I think you still have to consider them the team to beat. Philly has been uneven. I mean, boy, the bullpen there, had it not been for other things that baseball fans could wring their hands over, like the Red Sox, as you mentioned, boy, we'd be talking about a historically bad Philly bullpen. I mean, you take a 7-0 lead, as they did on Thursday, and can't finish that one. My goodness. And as a part of the doubleheader, you know, they're probably categorized as one of the bigger disappointments in baseball right now, because we all had them as being very good with the improvements that they've made. And when you consider Harper having such a great year, Realmuto having such a great year, that stuff's gone to waste. Bohm performing, coming up out of nowhere. The Phillies are kind of a disappointment. The Braves, I would consider the team to beat. And then beyond that, you can put the Mets and Nationals in a bag, mix it up, and pull out a different name every 30 seconds, and I'd probably be fine with that. And I also believe that the Marlins, as nice as their story was in terms of coming back and winning 7 out of 8 after their COVID layoff, they've fallen back down to earth pretty easily here. And I think that's more indicative of who they are than when they won the 7 of 8. So I'll answer your question by saying Atlanta. And then you fill in the blank.
Well, in the Mets situation, now complicated by the fact that the team has been shut down. You had a player and a staffer reportedly test positive for coronavirus. What a weird year when it feels like, yeah, we've been there before. We know how they're going to handle this. They're just going to keep plowing ahead. When we first started to have these little outbreaks within teams, there was always the concern to be shut down. Matt, they're not shutting down. It's full steam ahead. Damn the torpedoes.
Yeah, close your eyes, plug your nose, and they will move heaven and earth to make sure something close to 60 games is completed for every team, and that the league can get to its expanded playoff format with all the additional revenues that brings, and then get to a postseason. What that's going to look like with no fans, I don't know, but it will be a postseason. There will be fall baseball, thank goodness. And I was among those, not to be a told-you-so guy, but I think you were in this camp too, Buster. I didn't think they were going to stop for anything short of multiple teams with multiple players at the same time on the COVID IL. But these independent outbreaks, as bad as they are, as troubling as they are, I think, you know, the league views the 30 teams as 30 different fiefdoms, and some of the internal medical conditions and policies, it's up to them to deal with it. That means the league keeps going without him. And, you know, say the Marlins thing had gotten worse, say the Cardinals thing had gotten worse. The question then would have become, at what point does the kingdom kind of cut ties with one of the members of the fiefdom, if you will? A terrible, like, pre-Elizabethan analogy that I'm trying to draw here. But you know, we didn't get to that, luckily. So, yes, they're going to plug through, man. They're going to get these games in, and we're getting to that expanded format come hell or high water.
There was a general manager back at the beginning of summer camp, amid a lot of skepticism that I was hearing. Some people said there's no chance. You know, their view was it was such a mess. You know, based on those comments, I said on radio at the beginning, I thought 0% chance to get through the whole season, 5% chance to get to the start of the regular season. But there was one general manager in particular who I compliment every time I talk to him, like, you read it. He said, once the ball gets rolling, if we get the regular season started, are you kidding? It's a business. And they're going to do everything they can to make that work. And I think you're right. If you did have outbreaks when we got in September, I think they would isolate those teams. And they'd say, well, you know what? You know, Team X, sorry, you're just not going to be part of it, but we're moving ahead because we want to get to the postseason.
Yeah, and you know, there's no way that one of the four major North American sports leagues is going to remove itself from the rotation and yield the entire viewership stage to the other three games. There's just no way. It's too important for each of the teams. And the NHL in its Canadian two bubble cities for its playoffs, the NBA in their bubble, and it remains to be seen what the NFL is going to look like. But I, you know, as a baseball person, I can't stand the comparisons that some casual fans try to make between the way the NBA is handling its business and what baseball is having to do. Completely different animals. You just yep. can't compare. And say baseball had gone ahead and done a quote-unquote bubble plan with the three ballparks that were rumored to be in play a number of months ago. And they went ahead and tried to schedule all the games in Miami, Texas, in Arlington, and in Arizona. Well, you know, those three municipalities are not in terrific shape in terms of the virus right now. That would have been a disaster. So as it turns out, the plan that they chose was, in my mind, the right path. And we, you know, here we go. Let's get through the next, whatever it is, 55% of the schedule, because we're almost halfway there now. And let's get to the playoffs.
Want to talk about Shane Bieber, who last night, another great start. And I was looking at his numbers this morning, Matt. He's faced 150 batters, and of those, he struck out 65. He's allowed 5 runs the whole year, 4 of those on home runs. Runners in scoring position, 41 innings or 40 and two-thirds innings that he's pitched. And there have only been 10 situations in which a batter came up with a runner in scoring position, and they're 0 for 10. When we were lucky enough to have him on a Sunday night broadcast a couple weeks ago, and there are not many times when you're doing a broadcast and you're watching a pitcher's stuff and it's kind of taking your breath away. But that start, watching his cut fastball in particular, its curveball, good Lord, I don't know how anybody hits him.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, you have that same kind of breathlessness when you watch him as when you watch a handful of other guys in the league, like Gerrit Cole. I don't know if you saw anything of Casey Mize's debut the other night,
yes.
But, man, there were some flashes in there where you're like, my goodness, that's his split-finger fastball. It moves like a screwball. And boy, those guys are fun to watch. The way they can manipulate the ball, and I'll use a pitching coach term, shape their pitches. By the way, I don't ever remember hearing people talking about shaping pitches before Rapsodo and some of the baseball factories that exist around the country now. Yeah, man, Bieber is fun to watch. And when he first came up, I don't know that any of us took him seriously as an ace in wait. He had terrific minor league numbers. Maybe we should have taken him that seriously. Had always been a huge kind of strikeout to walk ratio guy. Those numbers were always really great and in line with the guy that could play in the big league level. But maybe it's because he came from UCSB, and it's a very small, intimate list of major league players to have come from the University of California at Santa Barbara. Not a lot of gauchos out there. I mean, just top of mind, I know Chris Spire went to UCSB, Quinn Mack, UCSB guy, Ryan Spielborgs, UCSB guy, but it's a small list, right? So he didn't come with the kind of pedigree that would indicate that this guy's in there. And I've heard you talk about this too, Bieber. There's something in the sauce in Cleveland. There's something they do developmentally with the Aaron Civales and the, you know, Zach Plesacs and Mike Clevengers, even though that discussion has taken a different track. There's something that happens with those guys when they get there that takes them to the next level. We give the Astros a lot of credit for bringing great pitchers to the uber great level. I think we have to have that conversation about the Indians as well.
The Elias Sports Bureau sent out this note. Shane Bieber is the fourth pitcher, fifth instance in the modern era since 1900. It was 65 strikeouts in his first 6 starts of a season. 1978, Nolan Ryan had 71. 2000, Pedro Martinez, 67. 2001, Pedro Martinez, 66. And then you have Shane Bieber and Curt Schilling with 65. So he's off to an incredible start. Sean Anderson of the Giants, not so much. The other night, he had a couple pitches near Mike Trout's head. The Angels took exception. Well, it went another level last night when he threw another ball near Trout's head, and it prompted Joe Maddon to come out of the dugout, complain to the umpires. Matt, give a listen to Joe Maddon after that game.
Well, enough is enough. You know, I mean, listen, there's a major leagues. There's a level of accountability here also. I don't want to use the word irresponsible loosely, but in that situation, you pretty much knew it was going to happen again. I'm not accusing the guy of doing anything on purpose. I'm just saying he's not, doesn't command his fastball enough in order to know where it's going. I mean, and just roll reversal, switch the situations. And if we had done that to them and how they would feel about, you know, the player of Trout's stature, third ball in twice that we faced them, too close. It can't happen. It just can't happen. The kid's got 8 walks per 9 innings. So it's not an anomaly moment for him.
You know, what's interesting, Matt, is I went back and looked at his minor league numbers, and Sean Anderson actually had good command during the time in his career. One season, 2018, he had 3.8 strikeouts to walks, but something's changed. He clearly is flying open. It almost feels like that, yes, it's inevitable that something like this would happen given all the pitchers that are being used this year. Because there are guys who are pitching the major leagues who are probably not major league pitchers.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, Joe is good, isn't he? Like, he is always so measured when he makes statements like that. And he's always very careful. He's very diplomatic and skilled in not fueling any fires. And I think, and this is my opinion, Joe is probably not convinced that he was, quote unquote, flying open and just erratic. Because how does that happen? How do you miss around the same guy's head 3 times over back-to-back appearances? And on Wednesday night, I saw the second one live without knowing that the first one had existed. And then when you're made aware of the first one, which to me was even worse, one is in front of him around his head. The other one is behind him around his head. And then it happens again. How in the world on Wednesday did the umpires convene, which they did after the second, bow tie pitch, as Satchel Paige used to call it, and determine that they weren't going to run him out of the game? I mean, at some point, it's hard to separate intent from results sometimes because we really don't know the intent. But when the results look that bad, again, when it, you know, if it acts like a duck and walks like a duck, it's a duck. You're gone, dude. I don't care if you're erratic or not. You can't miss around a superstar, anybody's head. Let's put it that way. But especially in that circumstance with a player that's that important to the game. And again, I probably put myself in a bad spot there with this argument by talking about a superstar getting a superstar treatment. But look, that's the reality of it. It's Mike Trout. He should have been removed from the game after that second one on Wednesday night. It was unbelievable to me that he wasn't.
Yeah, as you were talking, I was reminded of that that crazy, what was it? I think it was an exhibition game. Remember when Doc Ellis was pitching and he was mad at the Cincinnati Reds, I think, and he like hit the first 4 guys in the exhibition game. And at some point, the umpires are like, you know what, Doc, you might want to go. Okay, that's it. We're just not going to have you just sit here and hit every guy. You know, you're gone. We don't know for sure if you're doing it on purpose, but if you're close enough, we're gonna kick you out.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to, like, you know, it'd been back in the day when these things were legislated a little bit differently by umpires. The famous Padres Braves brawl in 1984, when it started with Eddie Lee Whitson and Melito Perez coming after each other or coming after each other's guys, and had like 4 or 5 different mini incarnations within the same envelope of the game where guys were getting thrown at and charging the mound. It's different now. And umpires are supposed to nip that in the bud. Again, how he wasn't removed from the game, ejected from the game, is beyond me, because it didn't look good at all.
All right, Matt. Good to talk with you. Thanks for doing this.
Got it, Buster. Anytime. Good talking to you.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
Dansby Swanson is a shortstop of the Atlanta Braves in his fifth season playing Major League Baseball. Dansby, how you doing?
I'm doing good. Just enjoying life and everything that has to offer.
Well, along those lines, I'm waiting for someone like you when this season's over to write a book about 2020, about playing professional sports. Because, I mean, you played sports your whole life. You come from a family where everybody played sports. How would you describe what this year has been like?
I think it's definitely been crazy. I think that's to say the least. But I think the biggest blessing for me and where I've gotten to, you know, just mentally and emotionally and spiritually and physically, like all those things is, with this time, like you really get reminded how important each day is. You get reminded that, you know, health and everything is something not be taken for granted, and that ultimately, you know, like, we're not really the ones in control here. You know, I'm a faith oriented guy, and it's just allowed me to lean on my faith even more so during these times that, you know, God's always got a plan, and our job is to consistently, you know, seek that purpose and calling in our lives. And I feel like this time has like really been a blessing because you've been able to kind of slow down for once, you know, and really cut out some of the distractions. And we don't realize how fast we move in this world. And so when you don't have all that stuff, when it's not readily available. So that for me is like has been one of the biggest changes I feel like I've seen for me this year, even amidst all the other stuff going on.
Dansby, how long into the shutdown did it sort of take you to get to that place that you just described? Because obviously, it's such an unusual situation. We didn't know if baseball was going to be played, when it's going to be played. How long did it sort of take you to have that thinking evolve?
I mean, I think there was definitely a roller coaster to it. Initially, I feel like I was in a really good headspace of, you know, I'm going to be pushing myself every day to get to a point to where when things do start back up again, I'm going to be ready. I think that for a while, I feel like that was the mentality. And then all of a sudden it kind of shifts to, well, what am I actually working towards? Because I don't know if this is actually going to happen or not. And you start battling with those things. And with that comes a lot of, you know, anxiousness and things of that nature. So I would battle back and forth with that roller coaster going up and down until, you know, I feel like about maybe like early June, it really started to change for me. Late May, early June, things started to change. And I started putting my energies and my thoughts in the right direction. And since then, not that it's been perfect by any means, but it's been consistently growing towards, you know, kind of that goal.
How did Freddie Freeman's illness play a role in how you were feeling about things? Because I got to tell you, you know, as someone who's known Freddie a long time, it was moving, you know, to hear him after the fact and to hear Nick Markakis before that relate the conversation he had with Freddie when Freddie was sick. And at the time, Nick had opted out. That to me, that was jarring to experience that. I'm sure as a teammate who knows Freddie a lot better than I do, is along those lines for you.
Yeah, I think what it did for a lot of people was it just kind of said, it showed people that, you know, doesn't matter who you are, you know, you can still get sick. And I think it was just showed us that it was even more important to take care of our health. I don't think that I was ever scared or nervous or anything like that. But it was just kind of a reminder that, you know, taking care of yourself, not that Freddie wasn't, but just in general, taking care of yourself and doing things to maintain a healthy lifestyle are very, very, very important. And it just gave me the opportunity to be able to, you know, talk to Freddie some and just check in on him. I mean, that was my first thought was really like, okay, well, if you and your family is, you know, sick and has it, you know, what can I do to help you guys? Is there anything that I can, you know, bring over or, you know, somehow get it to you without being exposed to y'all, just to try and, you know, help out. So I feel like that was where, you know, my heart and brain took me, not necessarily, you know, nervous about the season.
Now, I've always been one who watched major leaguers like you play, and I, you know, had always witnessed players who responded to the adrenaline from crowds. But I got to tell you, I have been shocked at how much of a difference it makes. I've been to 3 games in person, and I feel like that all along for players, it's been, you know, there's been a search like to try to replicate in some way what you draw from fans. What's been your experience with that?
I mean, I think it'd be silly to say that playing without fans, you know, it's the exact same feel, right? I think that that'd be silly to say. But I also do think that it's important to remember that, you know, this has kind of given us the opportunity to get back to playing just the game for the game itself, and kind of the purity of the game, just being able to go compete with your teammates and, you know, compete for something much bigger than yourself. And I think that this year has kind of given people the opportunity to do so, where you just go and play 9 innings, if that's how long it takes, or more, depending if you go into extras or not. And, you know, just really playing the game with nothing else to it other than the sole game itself, which has been really neat for me. And I always told people, I said, I really don't know if it'll bother me, because when you're in college and you're doing, you know, fall inter squads, when it's 35 degrees out, there ain't nobody there either. You know, there ain't nobody there. So it's kind of the same type of thing, just better weather.
Yeah, just competing against the game, which, you know, coaches right. Like Tim Corbin, your coach at Vanderbilt, you know, other basketball coaches I've talked to, they talk about that, competing against the game. You got, when you had a walk-off homer the other day, you had a celebration at home plate afterward. Just tell me about how you guys decided in this socially distanced 2020 to come up with that celebration.
Well, we didn't come up with it. It just happened.
Is that right?
I'll tell you, it was very awkward and it was very weird. And it still makes me a little bit uncomfortable thinking about it now. But I just remember jumping up kind of like on the plate. And then I turned around because I was expecting people to be back there too. And there wasn't anybody back there. So I felt like a fool turning around. So I turned back around and then it was kind of over and people didn't know whether to high five or not, because we've been trying to stay away from that on the team. So it was definitely a different experience, but you know, I'm very thankful to be able to have done that and be able to, you know, be around my teammates to do it.
You guys have had a ton of adversity. You know, you lose Soroka, Acuna down, Albies down, but you're in first place. How are you doing that?
I mean, we got good players, man. Like, We have a lot of talent in this place, and everyone's kind of under the same standard that, you know, we play to win the game. And I think that that mentality, along with the depth of talent, is what makes us successful. And I feel like that's what's made us successful over the past couple of years. And it'll continue to serve us well. Because, I mean, top to bottom, that we have great players in the whole player pool, the minor league system, everything. You know, that's what we value. And also just the personality piece. The people that are in this building care a lot about it, care a lot about each other, and they care about that common goal of winning. So all those 3 things combined leads to good results.
That's exactly what you told me when I saw you in March in Tampa. You're like, we got a lot of good players on this team, and that's certainly you know, showing through here. Before you go, you know, the big topic of conversation the last couple of days has been about the baseball's unwritten rules and Fernando Tatis Jr. swinging on 3-0. Where do you fall on that conversation? What do you think is the best way to go about that?
Yeah, I've kind of gone back and forth about it. And I think that there's definitely an argument to both sides, and I can't really give you which side that I would be on, because now, do I think that what he did was extremely disrespectful? Like, no. But I do think that there are certain rules, that unwritten rules, that do get followed. And, you know, you can kind of chalk it up to that. And we hope to learn and grow from each, whether it's a mistake or not. You know, I mean, that's not from, I'm not here to be the almighty, you know, baseball unwritten rule judge. So, you know, it is what it is. It happened. And that's kind of up for other people to, you know, interpret, not me.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time, Dansby.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Todd Radom, is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all across America, all around the world, or you can go to his website, Todd Radom, toddradom.com.
Correct.
Okay. Todd, how are you doing this week?
I'm well, Buster. How was your vacation?
It was good, but it was kind of unusual, you know, to be following baseball from afar, knowing that even if I was back home, I wouldn't be able to be in a ballpark. And this week, when I sent you the note about which ballpark we're going to talk about, you mentioned the Coliseum in Oakland, and I knew right away that I was not qualified in a way that Matt Viskirjan is qualified to talk about the Coliseum because he bleeds all things Oakland Athletics. So we're bringing Matt back. Matt, meet Todd Radom, and we got to hear your memories of the Coliseum, your favorite game, and tell us about the ballpark itself.
Oh, man. Hi, Todd. Yeah, you know it, as is a common phrase, I think, in sports, it might be a dump, but it's our dump. And I definitely feel that way about the Oakland Coliseum, a place that was born in a time when you know, multi-purpose stadiums were thought to be the wave of the future. As such, baseball has always looked a little different there because I think in its purest form, the Coliseum is a football stadium. But, you know, back in the day, it was great. And I grew up in the Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area and the East Bay specifically in the 1970s, my formative years when the A's and Raiders were both good. The Raiders throughout the decade, the A's in the beginning of the decade. But even when the A's weren't great, the Coliseum was always busy with Bill Graham Presents Day on the Green concerts. And I saw a number of those there. But I don't know, there was always something about the Coliseum that was pleasant as a kid because I didn't have a reference point to Fenway Park or Wrigley Field or any place else for that matter. And by the way, in the 70s, there were other rotten multi-purpose stadiums that were out there, like the ones in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and Cincinnati. And at least ours had natural grass and sunlight instead of AstroTurf and summer rain and humidity. So back in the day, again, before they filled in center field, when the Raiders returned from Los Angeles and Al Davis kind of manipulated the County Coliseum execs into putting luxury suites up there, which, by the way, were never very luxurious at all. They ruined what was the best part of the ballpark, which was the kind of big, wide open, semi-panoramic view of the Oakland Hills. You could see the BART station. You could see the Ascension Greek Church up there, which was a notable church in Oakland. And it was kind of fun. It was kind of pleasant. You were super far away from the players. But again, as a kid that had no other reference point with any other ballpark, that somehow didn't bother me.
Yeah, I think, Matt, you make a couple of great points. Number one, I think one of the really cool things about this ongoing conversation is hearing from fans all season long about their memories. And ballparks contain millions and millions of memories. These places where we went to games with people who may not be here anymore. And to your point, yes, every dump is our dump. We feel very proprietary about them. And I remember my first visit to the Oakland Coliseum was in the very early 90s, pre-Mount Davis, a very different experience, as you point out. And I'd say, yes, it's falling apart. It's a concrete monstrosity, but it really is a unique and very fun baseball experience. It's nearly devoid of the bland, vanilla, corporate sterility that's come to define the current generation of ballparks. But it's got personality. And let's face it, as you said, there's plenty of room to spread out. I have to say, being a New Yorker, I am very much reminded when I walk through that cage approaching the stadium, through this industrial area, it reminds me of the old plexiglass tunnel that connected the parking lots on the Major Deegan Expressway to the old Yankee Stadium. So, you know, hallowed ground is hallowed ground. And, you know, like I said, I do make this very definite connection. A couple of notes that I've taken down. I am holding in my hands a 1968 Oakland A's media guide, first season after they moved from KC. And in this media guide, the Coliseum is touted. 41,632 individual contoured plastic seats, 1,756 lamps that lit the ballpark for night games. The world's most, quote, educated and advanced scoreboard, a Charles O'Finley innovation quote, positively designed with a fan experience uppermost in mind. And I did find out that the distance to the backstop was originally 90 feet. Can you imagine?
Wow.
I mean, you would have seen absolutely nothing with a quote unquote great seat behind home plate. That's, you know, there were also things there, Todd, that started at the Coliseum, and it, you know, the wave is not exactly the kind of thing you're going to hang your cap on. But crazy George Henderson, who was a San Jose State guy who had this skill for kind of mobilizing big groups of fans, he started the wave at the Oakland Coliseum, and it was easy to do there because it's symmetrical and round and easy to kind of see what's happening. And the wave, as much as it was a terrible affectation of the 80s in the minds of some, for me, brings back positive memories of being an A's fan as a kid. I was at that game in 81. It was one of the ALCS games against the Yankees when it started, and everybody's like, what is this? Oh my God, this is so cool. This is so Oakland. And that fan base, to your point too, Todd, has kind of made the experience unique there. Yankee Stadium has its bleacher creatures, and there's a bleacher creatures element in Oakland, even though the bleachers no longer exist in the outfield. They were torn out again for the Mount Davis bastardization of the building that occurred. But, you know, there are things there that are unique. And I know that when and if that place finally comes down, the same way when County Stadium finally came down, all the years of lamenting what a bad ballpark it's been will go away, and people will oddly miss the joint. I think Mets fans can kind of relate to that too.
Yeah, totally. I recall going to games in the waning days of Shea Stadium. Same thing with the Vet and Philly, with the wires hanging out of the walls. And Matt, what you said at the outset, it may be a dump, but it's our dump. I heard in both of those places, and as somebody who is old enough to have visited something like 52 stadiums along the way, even the dumpiest of dumps that we have talked about throughout the season, the exhibition stadiums in Toronto and Arlington Stadium in Texas, and we can go on and on and on, again, contain millions and millions of memories, and it's part of the thing that makes baseball so special. It's such a grind, not only for the players, but for the fans. And if you attend enough games in these places, you're going to be left with memories like this.
I'm a baseball card guy from way back. And if you look at the Topps sets, starting in about 71, 72, certainly by 73, a majority of the cards for players from the American League were shot in that ballpark. Yep. I don't know what the deal was at the time, but Topps must have had a staff photographer in the Bay Area. And so when the Red Sox would come through, when any American League team would come through, his card is, there's a very good chance that that photo was taken at the Oakland Coliseum, which always makes me smile.
Wow. That's true.
All right, Matt, as part of this, you get to step in and pinch hit for me in the weekly quiz. You'll be going against Taylor Schwenk. Todd, go ahead.
All right, here we go. In 1963, A's owner Charlie Finley successfully petitioned the American League so that his team could do the following. Was it A, wear white uniforms on the road? B, wear uniform numbers on their sleeves? C, wear sleeveless vests? Or D, add nicknames to the backs of their uniforms? Charlie Finley, 1963 in Kansas City, petitioned the American League so that the A's could wear white uniforms on the road, wear uniform numbers on their sleeves, wear sleeveless vests, or D, add nicknames to the backs of their jerseys. You got a 25% chance, Matt.
Well, and Taylor, according to the rules of our contest, Taylor will go first and make his best guess, I'm guessing.
All right, guys. Well, classic Buster trying to enlist someone else to help his cause to catch up to me, but I'm going to go vests or white unis. Both sound appealing. I'm going to go vests.
Yeah. You know, I don't think the nickname stuff, because he started hanging nicknames, like Charlie Finley was the guy that began calling Catfish Hunter Catfish Hunter. He wanted to call Vita Blue True Blue, and that didn't resonate, certainly not with Vita. So I think the nickname thing came later. I'm going to say White on the Road.
Well, you're both wrong. I'm sorry to say that, Matt. I'm sorry to say that, Taylor. It was wear uniform numbers on their sleeves. This was a controversial thing because of the fact that a pitcher could hide a pitch or it could be dangerous. But a couple of things to note here. Finley did petition the AL to wear white uniforms on the road. He was turned down by Joe Cronin. They did wear sleeveless vests, the first AL team to do so. And believe it or not, Matt, in mid-1963, the A's added nicknames to the backs of their uniforms. Charlie Finley, a pioneer in so many ways. But these were not the inspired nicknames that came after. Instead, you got Tony for Tony La Russa, Hawk for Hawk Harrelson, things like that.
I love it.
Awesome. Well, Matt, thanks for joining us on this thing. And thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Hey. Thanks, Buster. Thanks, Taylor.
Oh, thanks, guys. Thank you.
Bleacher Tweets.
All righty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday. First one up, our pal Jason Amico at Jason Amico writes in, with my Giants finally calling up Joey Bart to the big leagues, I am reminded of the heavily anticipated arrival of Buster Posey for his cup of coffee in 2009 and his Rookie of the Year tear that took us to the World Series title in 2010. Who was the most heavily anticipated young catcher to arrive in the show in baseball history that performed best to fulfill expectations? He says Posey comes to mind, but Johnny Bench, Yogi Berra, Pudge Rodriguez, Joe Mauer also stick out.
Yeah, it's hard to compare hype machines from the current era where you have social media compared to what was in the past. Buster Posey, I think, would probably be the answer. I do remember when Johnny Bench was a young player, or reading about it. I wasn't really a baseball fan when he actually broke in. But I remember going back and looking at some of the stories that were written about him. And there was a thought that he was going to be one of the great catchers of all time. And he is the greatest catcher of all time. There's a lot of hype about Joe Mauer, too. Of course, he's a multi-sport athlete. But I'd say Johnny Bench if it's not Buster Posey.
Last one for the week. Christina Hayes at CL underscore Hayes writes in, do you know on average how many more baseballs are being used per game this season? I would guess that it's more with the new rules for safety. What's the word, Buster?
So I did not know the answer to this, but I checked with folks at Major League Baseball, and here's what I got back. Our rough estimate is that approximately 900,000 baseballs are used by all 30 clubs per year throughout spring training, batting practice, and games. Approximately 300,000 of those are used for games. I think you probably could prorate to get a base number, but there's also a feeling that they're far more liberal this year about throwing baseballs out of play. It might be twice as many baseballs per game as what we've seen in other years, just because of the coronavirus concerns.
Wow. That's a lot of baseballs.
A lot of baseballs.
Good way to end the week. Thanks for listening, everyone. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And please subscribe, rate, and review to this fine podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. Have a nice weekend, everyone.
My thanks today to Dansby, to Matt, to Todd, and to Taylor. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, everyone. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color are things we should fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, a Foxaloner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus Chews provides one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurological disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.